Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Reluctant Assassin by Philippa Norcross and Michael Anderle. Narrated by Patricia Santomasso. Chapter 1. Cora flipped her coat's collar up around her ears as she strolled along the sidewalk. It wasn't exactly in fashion. She wasn't sure it ever had been, or ever would be. But luckily for her, it didn't set her apart too much. She was in Copenhagen in the middle of the summer, and had been a vampire for half a year? Something like that. It was frightening how quickly time stopped having meaning when you were effectively immortal. Immortal with maintenance. Just need to give the system a bit of a tune-up occasionally, she thought, treading the boards of the old joke conversation she'd had with herself countless times. Top up the blood tank and she'll run as good as new for a few hundred more years. Shame about the age thing, but it's unavoidable with models like these. The joke was that she would never age. Not without magical intervention, and that process was so new and experimental that Cora had no desire to test it on herself. She had even less interest in trying it on a child, which was happening elsewhere in the world. But she didn't have any say in that. Cora's footsteps padded on the concrete, her shadow sliding from streetlight to streetlight as she followed her target, and she reflected on the roller coaster her life had become. She chuckled underneath her breath. Roller coaster. Tivoli Gardens was nearby, the second oldest amusement park in the world. She thought she could still hear the carnival music if she listened closely. Were they still open? She checked her watch. Friday night, they were operating for another couple of hours. She probably could hear the carnival music. This was an excellent place to lurk and clandestinely meet. People wandered the streets all the time in strange get-ups, tourists and locals alike, and a myriad of languages drifted through the air. Cora didn't speak Danish, but was pretty good with languages, so she was getting along. It helped that she didn't have to eat if she didn't want to. Well, she had to drink blood. That part of being a vampire wasn't a myth. Human blood was best, or whatever kind of blood you had running through your veins when you became a vampire. Fey and elven ancestry tended to change that, and it could be incredibly addictive for some. Cora was one of the unlucky sods for whom human blood was addictive, and after her first taste of it months back, she'd been working steadily on tempering that urge whenever she was in big population centers. In cities, that meant subsisting mostly on birds and rodents. Not pleasant, but there were worse diets. In the country, she could more successfully hunt rabbits and game of that size. Nothing bigger unless she was near hunting grounds or farmsteads of people who could handle a carcass. Her life had changed so much in the past 6 months, and it was all turning around in her mind like the pretzel dough the street vendor up ahead of her was twisting into shapes before sticking it in a portable oven. She'd been diagnosed with brain cancer. Presented with the choice to become a vampire or die, she'd agonized over the decision. When a car accident had killed her boyfriend Matt, she'd finally opted to transform. In hindsight, it was mostly to avenge his death. She'd felt she could do something about the lack of investigation. Unfortunately, she'd discovered that Matt's death had indeed been an accident, and his twin sister Maggie had not been in a fit emotional state to talk. It had ended up being fine, although it hurt like hell, because in discovering the truth about Matt's death, she'd also walked into a doomsday cult. That had led to picking up two kids, Andrew and Andrea Tasman. The cult calling themselves the Evolved had consumed their parents. 6 months and several adventures later, Cora had traveled to Italy, Australia, and Greece on the credit card of one Madame Antonova, the vampire matriarch who had sired her and in whose technical employ she was technically not an assassin. Cora had ethical issues with being an assassin. The world didn't give a damn about her scruples. Cora was now hunting for the stone. the semi-mythical figure at the heart of the Evolved. She planned to end the Doomsday Cult once and for all. She'd caught up to the Stone in Greece only weeks before, where she'd wounded them before being knocked out by the self-sacrifice ritual conducted by their second-in-command, Chris. The Stone had gotten away, as all supervillains do on occasion, and Cora had spent a couple of weeks regrouping and resting at one of Madame Antonova's many properties worldwide. This one was in London, where Andrea and Andrew stayed hidden from their erstwhile guardians and current hunters. Andrea was the one the Evolved wanted most. At the tender age of 11, she was a prodigy who could ward on the molecular level. Her ability to protect DNA from mutation made her the Evolved's number one most wanted. It wasn't surprising, since their ultimate goal was nuclear Armageddon, with a magical supremacist society rising from the ashes. The head honchos wanted to come out of it without extra heads. Andrew was older by a year and a half and had a magically perfect memory. This had proven invaluable in their escape and subsequent botheration of the cult. However, it was unfortunately less flashy than his sister's powers and was a source of resentment on the kid's part. Cora had never been sure about having kids, but unexpectedly became the de facto mother to these two. Although she'd been absent more often than not over the last months, this and her attempts to be supportive and loving while she was there was more parental love than either of their biological parents had given them. Also, she was falling in love with her trainer, Jack. The vampire turned in the Roaring Twenties taught at Madame Antonova's Academy for Young Vampires in the Appalachians. He cut a fine figure in coattails, and about anything else besides. Yeah, life was weird. Today in Copenhagen, so near the amusement park that she still heard the excited screams of riders, she was trailing an unwilling informant. The list of people who knew about the Stone, who knew about the person, not just the cult legend, was short. But once you knew where to look, they weren't hard to find. They were proving very hard to talk to, though. Much like Jillian, the Green Witch whom Cora had hunted down in the Australian outback only weeks before. Jillian had been the Evolved's primary plant creator until she'd defected and gone into hiding for her safety. The Stone was a master of intimidation. The last person Cora had tracked down had taken the cliched cracked-tooth cyanide pill rather than spill the beans. They had been defiant to the end, spouting bullshit about how the necromantic lord would raise them on the last day when the skies rained fire and the rivers ran with blood. Your standard doomsday crap. This person? With this person, Cora had believed she stood a chance. She'd gotten in contact as quietly as possible and had received an affirmative message in return. They were willing to talk, as long as they took the strictest protective measures. Cora had followed their directions to the letter, leaving nothing to chance. In return for all her conscientious hard work, they'd ghosted her. Bastard, or bitch, or whatever. Now she was tracking them down the hard way. Wending her way through Copenhagen's more heavily trafficked streets as time went by, still on their tail after she'd zeroed in on them hours before, she inexorably approached her prey. It was the worst time of day to see, even in the theoretically well-lit city streets. The constant light overhead, paired with the awkward light of the sun setting over a city that never went dark, meant that most human eyes couldn't see all that well. Vampire eyes had no such trouble. Cora had paced herself through the day, coming closer to her target every few minutes, but staying far enough back that she wouldn't catch them until they were truly exhausted. It was the persistence method of hunting, a time-tested human tradition, and it worked as well for superhumanity as it did for the hunters of thousands of years ago. But now, she was less than a city block away from them. They kept glancing over their shoulder, checking to see that Cora was still there. Earlier in the day, it caused them to sprint for a while or duck into a store in an attempt to lose her. At one point, they threw themselves off a bridge into a canal. Now it meant a couple of hurried steps, followed by a return to the pace that had been slowing for hours. Any minute now. Any minute. She tightened the distance between them to half a block. Her informant glanced over their shoulder again.
Leave me alone! You'll get me killed!
They called, after furtive glances left and right. No glance up, however. That might mean the stone's operatives didn't often attack from above. It might mean they were too panicked to follow real, sensible, defensive checks. If you knew about magic, you didn't only look left and right. You also looked up. A couple of passers-by looked at them, but it seemed they didn't speak English. That was a stroke of luck for Cora. She didn't want to explain anything to the Danish police.
I only want to talk, Cora called. I'm not going to hurt you.
I don't care,
they yelled, then stumbled. They were on their last legs. Soon, Cora would have her answers.
If you don't, they will.
I can protect you, she promised. You're not the only one I'm protecting.
They let out a demented, desperate laugh as they sagged against a light pole.
You don't know anything. They can destroy the world. You can't protect me against that.
Then tell me what I need to know so I can,
Cora insisted, swooping in to cover the last few meters before they could push off the pole and make another run for it. They squeaked as Cora was abruptly in their face and tried to push the vampire away.
I know what you are. I can smell you,
they cried, panic lacing every syllable. I'm not going to hurt you, Cora repeated. I only want to talk. Can we go somewhere safe? That frantic laugh again.
There is nowhere safe.
The hood that had covered their face this whole time fell back to reveal a woman with extraordinary pale skin and chin-length black hair, untidy and sweaty from the day of uninterrupted pursuit. Her skin was melting very fast. Cora stepped back in horror as the woman's eyes popped in their sockets and oozed down her cheekbones, which were drifting down toward her jaw like logs in a river as she melted from the inside out. The wave of heat and the stench was suddenly unbearable. Cora had to cover her nose and mouth with her sleeve to avoid losing her hastily eaten dinner, which roiled in her gut. The last thing she'd seen in the woman's eyes was pure terror. This wasn't like the guy who'd taken himself to his grave. This had been a remote kill. The stone was taking precisely zero chances, and they knew exactly what Cora was up to. Chapter 2. As Cora turned away from the rapidly evanescing pool of liquid that had once been her informant to be, a lashing pain curled around her left calf. She cried out. She couldn't help it. The pain was agonizing, like a brand and a whip all in one. She stumbled back from the lamppost they'd been standing under and looked around. Could no one else see what was going on? There had been pedestrians nearby only moments ago, conspicuously ignoring what was not their business. Now, Cora wished for nothing more than a busybody passerby. Not because they were likely to be able to do anything. She knew from experience that this spell had to be the stone's work. But if this was her last moment, she wanted to be seen. There was no one. The street was empty, and when she looked into the pool of light at her feet, the last dregs of corpse soup were gone. Cora was entirely alone with a fire in her leg that was spreading upward. She had to move or she would die. Maybe this was a failsafe, a dead man switch, or another remote curse. In any case, the stone was taunting her. You can't see me. You can't track me. You can't stop me. Cora wrested her consciousness away from the pain and onto her magic. She gathered energy from within, sensing it flowing through her veins and into her fingertips. Once you focused on vampiric magic, it felt trippy. She touched her leg, and all the magic shot to where she made contact. Some went through her fingertips, and some coursed through the rest of her body, whichever was the path of least resistance. In short order, the pain diminished. It wasn't gone, not entirely. And when she put weight on her left foot, her knee threatened to buckle. But she could limp on it. If it wasn't too obvious an act of vandalism, she'd wrench a piece of railing off a nearby fire escape or bridge and use it as a walking stick. However, there was nothing suitable in view, and it would have been too obvious. The pain lessening meant the spell had probably been a dead man's switch enchantment, something attached to the curse that had melted her informant from the inside out. A faint smell of iron still carried on the breeze. Now that Cora's attention wasn't solely on her survival, it turned her stomach. Rather ironic. Wasn't she supposed to love the smell of blood? Not when it's tainted like that. It reminded her of the stench that brought her to the stone in the first place, the stink of rotten magic that had floated in the air in Angolochori only weeks ago. Death magic. Bad death magic. She swallowed against the bile rising in her throat and made herself take a step away from the lamppost. It had a bar atop it, turning it into a makeshift cross in memoriam. She had a long way to go to get home. Cora limped back to her rented apartment. She'd opted not to take a cab. Too many questions. Too many people who could recognize her later, and too many opportunities for unscrupulous sorts. That meant she reached her accommodations in the wee hours of the morning after traversing the city and trading one liminal semi-light for the other. The clouds were the same purple as the sky. The upside of her journey taking as long as it did was that upon arrival, her leg had healed. She'd trickle-fed magic into it the whole time, while keeping as much weight off it as possible. When she stepped onto the stairs that led to her little bachelor pad, the calf muscle stretched with a pleasant burn instead of a horrible wrenching pain. She closed and locked the door behind her as her upstairs neighbor creaked over his floorboards, heading for his kitchen to make tea. The man was always up at the crack of dawn, which meant Cora was too. This building was old enough that there was no such thing as quiet, even when everyone was asleep. If Cora had been the type who believed in ghosts, she would have thought it haunted by the friendly kind of spirits, the old inhabitants of the building, who made tea every morning like the gentleman upstairs. Cora did not believe in ghosts, so she categorized and cataloged the sounds of the building and labeled them all as normal, including Mr. Johansson in apartment 306 with his 5 a.m. tea. Cora went to her kitchen, accompanied by Mr. Johansson's footsteps. She did not make tea. Instead, she went to her fridge and got out a jar. She grimaced as she set it on the kitchen counter, still with breadcrumbs scattered over it from the toast she'd eaten before embarking on her hunt the day before. The jar was 2/3 full of a thick paste whose color lay somewhere between Vegemite and tar. The smell was about as bad. The taste left something to be desired as well, but it wasn't as nasty as it smelled. More like cheese that was a little too old. Still, a spoonful of sugar would help this medicine go down, but it would probably render it utterly impotent. That was the last thing she needed right now. She grabbed a spoon from the cutlery drawer, popped the jar open, and scooped some out. Her nose wrinkled, and she plugged it with her other hand before sticking the spoon in her mouth and sucking the paste off the spoon. Cora forced herself to swallow, ignoring the uncomfortable feeling of pressure at the back of her nose until her esophagus finished its work, and she took the spoon from her mouth and tossed it in the sink. As soon as she let go of her nose, the overwhelming taste of iron flooded her senses, and she clapped one hand over her mouth and gripped the counter with the other, hard enough to turn her knuckles white. The taste wasn't bad, but the aftertaste was murder. Since this stuff was essentially ultra-concentrated blood, it didn't feel far from the truth. Madame Antonova had made a lightning-quick visit to the London safe house before Cora left and gave her the remedy, or maybe it would be more accurate to call it a pick-me-up.
"You cannot risk long recoveries on this mission," Antonova told Cora in a tone that brooked no argument. "If you are injured, even if you heal well, eat a spoonful of this. You may dilute it in warm water if you wish, but you must consume the entire portion at once.
Mmm, tasty blood tea. Cora had tried that the second time she'd taken the paste and had regretted her decision immediately. She'd chugged the whole cup, but had been left with a lingering taste of blood in her mouth and nose for hours. It wasn't necessarily unpleasant, but it made her hungry and was distracting. Now she stuck with the super-concentrated, gag-inducing single spoonful of doom. It was horrid for a few minutes, but then it went away. She could live with that. The things you did when you were hunting down an apocalypse monger. She shook her head as she crossed from the kitchen back into the living room and sank onto the couch, leaving Mr. Johansson's slow footsteps behind. The reality of what happened was sinking in since she wasn't moving anymore. Now that she was safe behind her layers of protection spells, wards and sigils designed for her by Andrea Tasman, which she applied painstakingly to every place she stayed. She closed her eyes, and her informant's melting face appeared on the back of her eyelids. She cringed and tried to look away, but since her eyes were already closed, it did her no good. Cora opened her eyes and stared at the ceiling, but all she saw in the plaster whorls on the ceiling were the swirls of magically decomposing matter that had been a person whose name she'd never found out. She knew the stakes were high, and always said yes every time she asked herself if she'd do it again. She couldn't allow these people to go unchallenged and the world to end if there was something she could do about it. How many more people would end up dying by the end of this? How many horrific deaths would she witness? How many of them would die by her hand? Her cough turned into a sob, and she covered her face with her hands, willing the images to disappear by focusing on something else, like her phone buzzing in her pocket. She missed her pocket on her first try, only pulling the phone out on her second blind shove. Her hands were sweaty. This was as much an after effect of Ivanova's remedy as it was her stress and distress. A text from Jack showed.
How did it go?
She swallowed hard. She'd spoken with Jack yesterday morning over breakfast. They'd taken to chatting for a few minutes at least once a day, talking about whatever was appropriate at the time. They asked each other about their plans for the day if it was morning. If it was evening, they checked on how everything had gone. Her finger hovered over the button that would initiate a call. It was something like midnight in the Appalachians, which was where she thought Jack still was. Not too late for a phone call, not if she already knew he was up. She didn't know if she could speak, so she typed instead. They got turned into soup, remotely. They didn't know it was coming, never got a chance to talk. She hit send and dropped her hand to her lap with the phone held loosely. It wasn't long before it buzzed again, and she tilted it up.
Damn, what an ass. I'm sorry, Cora.
She let her head fall back on the couch and let the phone slide out her hand, off her leg, onto the cushions beside her. She needed to meditate, or train, or something. Brooding wouldn't do her any good. Training probably wasn't a good idea yet. Her body needed rest. Meditation it was, then. She pulled her legs onto the couch and crossed them, settling in to simply be for a while. Her breathing was slowing when she heard the unmistakable sound of paper sliding under a door. She held her breath as her eyes popped open. Nothing else happened. Her wards didn't trigger. Andrea hadn't thought to ward against notes under doors. Cora retrieved the paper, which was cheap foolscap with blocky letters written with a ballpoint pen. What do you choose for this world? A slow death or a long life?
Asshole, Cora whispered, resisting the urge to crumple it.
It wouldn't have mattered if she did, since it lit up like flash paper a second later and burned to nothing before it hit the floor. Chapter 3. Cora woke to sunlight streaming through her bedroom window, She groaned, rolled over, and pulled the pillow with her, shoving it over her head to block out the offending rays. Technically, vampires didn't need to sleep, but it was one hell of a technicality that worked better the older you got. As it was, Cora's mind functioned better if she took time out every day, or at least every couple of days, to get some sleep. To take a break from her problems and pass out for a while. Even a nap did her a world of good. Sometimes, it felt like she got more out of sleep now that she was a vampire than she ever had as a human. Granted, she probably hadn't slept enough for a human. Now she got the right amount for a vampire. She squeezed the pillow tighter over her ears, blocking the street noises and, worse, the birds. Nothing kept her awake like birdsong. Vampires were weird. Vampire health was weird. Vampire brains were weird. The neuroscience of vampires must be fascinating. If you got a bunch of vampires together and studied them, you'd learn some incredible things, right? Like the interaction of the vampiric soul with the human body. What the hell did that mean? All these esoteric, magical things the vampiric community took for granted that no one had bothered to dig into or pick apart. She stopped her train of thought. That might not be true. There were quite a few vampires who had been around for centuries, and a couple who'd been around for millennia. They might have more knowledge of the ins and outs of vampirism than Cora did. She'd go so far as to say it was likely. The vampires who chose to live long lives tended to be the sane ones, and sane vampires usually devoted at least part of their lives to research or study of some type. That said, there was nothing to say those vampires would have studied themselves. It was as likely they'd chosen something as odd and off the wall as single-cell organisms that could grow in incredibly unpleasant conditions, the entire discography of the Beatles, or how the sky worked. Vampires weren't only weird, they were weird. On the flip side, she didn't know how many vampires there were. Would there be enough for a proper study? How many subjects did you need for a real clinical trial, or whatever you'd call it? If they needed a lot, she presumed whoever they were would need quite a few, they'd probably have to include some vampires who weren't as well controlled as she, Jack, and Antonova were. It would be a mess. Far more trouble than it would be worth. Results undoubtedly tainted somehow. Would it be a conflict of interest for a vampire to be the one conducting the study? That would be the only way you'd get someone long-lived enough to see it through if you did a longitudinal study. Some part humans lived long lives, didn't they? Fey blood, part elves, right? Maybe someone in one of those camps. She huffed and rolled onto her side, shoving the pillow back. All of this was speculative and pointless, no matter how curious it made her. What was it that made her tick? Why couldn't the vampire community figure themselves out via the scientific method instead of all of this magical trial and error that raised more questions than answers? Cora was tired of all the questions. She could have used some answers. Her phone buzzed. It took her a few minutes to read the message, needing to untangle herself from the messy bedsheets and locate the damn thing. It had ended up under the bed. She must have dropped it while falling asleep, reading another Merrily Watkins book until her eyes had slid shut. A text from the Green Witch she'd met in London, the one who'd put her onto Gillian Roundtree's path, showed. Volina Volskaya had informed Cora in no uncertain terms that finding Gillian for her would even her score with Ivanova Antonova. Volina Volskaya was still sending her information, despite that pronouncement. Sometimes, Cora didn't ask questions anymore.
Another contact in Copenhagen. Call in 20 minutes.
Cora rolled her eyes and sent back a confirmation. She suspected Volskaya had grown up under the watchful eye of the KGB, or one of their sister organizations in the neighboring SSRs. She was paranoid in a way Cora had never encountered, despite regularly mixing and mingling with spies and assassins these days. Volskaya maintained a quiet apartment and a quiet existence and was still alive. Still, She danced along the edges of circles, holding elements far more inflammatory than anyone Cora ran with.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?